Coming up on this In Contrast special, the second of seven episodes examining American media. I'm Ilan Stavans.
And I'm Ray Suarez.
In Contrast is a production of New England Public Radio and Quixote Productions.
Great to have you with us. We're calling this edition of the program, The Center Cannot Hold. And we want to talk to you this time about the idea that all those centers of authority that made the world a little bit readable, a little bit understandable, that made the world stable, are now in full retreat. And the public is wondering whether you can believe anybody or, Ilan Stavans, even more provocatively, I have to know why you're telling me something before I know whether or not I can believe you. Mm-hmm. Whether I'm in your classroom, whether I'm sitting in front of a television, whether I'm reading a book, unless I know the motives of the teller, I can no longer discern who's telling me the truth. And that's a pretty loosey-goosey, unstable world.
Because we are suspicious of whoever is handing down to us information, and we believe that that information has an agenda, has a purpose behind it. We are also at a time where the very concept of authority needs to be challenged from all sides, mindless of the fact that no matter how we test it, authority is intrinsic to the way we organize ourselves as a society. And that at some point, those that are at the bottom will be at the top, or those that are at the top will be at the bottom. There might be a rotating door, but there is always a need to organize ourselves in some way. I'm not thinking here of a dictatorial, one-sided approach, but of an intelligent, morally convincing, stable society that understands what is good and what is bad, because without that understanding, we would not last. The idea of the well-being is based on survival, on durability. And durability has, in and of itself, the embrace of the good life and the bad life. The bad life we often portray in the media as dangerous. Ultimately, I think there is this skeptical approach to trusting the source. And by not trusting the source, we have lost the capacity to be surprised in intellectual terms, in rational terms, because we are predicting what the message will be and what the climatic aspect of that message will be even before we start.
Here we are on the horns of this dilemma. You began by describing this new age of skepticism as a pretty good thing, that we were no longer as willing as a Middle Ages peasant to defer, to give authority, grant authority to the centers of authority, and also grant our attention to them, our unquestioned attention and our, it's gotten a bad name, but credulousness, our ability to believe those people. So, okay, fine. In this world, this is a more democratic world, a flatter world, so I don't have to automatically listen to what these centers of authority say. But is there a line that you cross where that becomes a place where the center cannot hold, where the world just now is a jangling collection of loose ends and people who don't believe anybody?
Sure. And that is because on the surface, one has the impression that being skeptical is being anti-authoritarian. But being skeptical is not that. Being skeptical means doubting, but not turning doubt into an idol. Doubt is a good strategy in order to sort out the world before us. But ultimately, you have to figure out ways not to succumb to doubt, but to believe. That is, to embrace belief. And belief will be good because there is good that comes with always questioning, with always doubting, but in the end saying there is a source, there is a vision, there is a concept of what is good, that I am going to embrace. Now, connected with this discussion that we're having on the media, one of the results of the fracturing that you were talking about at the very beginning of this episode is the fact that maybe 40 or 50 years, we had a center, and that center had the authority, meaning it was one newscaster on CBS or ABC or NBC at the 9 o'clock news who delivered the information. And the entire nation, for better or worse, tuned in. Everything was channeled through that individual, through that source, and the world got the sense that we were all united. What we have witnessed is the Balkanization, that is the fragmentation of the news media, where all the news that fits to print doesn't print in a single source, but it prints in a number of different sources, and more so with the internet, where every source claims to have some sort of authority. And so the question is, are we all paying attention to the same, with the same news? No. The same source? No. And what is the result of that? What is the outcome of lacking a center?
Well, we've given the consumer, the end consumer of these messages, an impossible task. We've told them, okay, we're in this new modern world with a lot of sources. You don't believe the church. You don't believe higher education. You don't believe scientists. You don't believe elected officials. You don't believe journalists. Fine. So you're showing what a intellectual gunslinger you are, what a tough guy you are. You don't believe anybody. But a world where you don't believe anybody is a really tough world to run. Because in that old world, I don't want to sound like a nostalgist, but that world that you talked to us about with the three newscasts, and along with the three newscasts, there were three national weekly news magazines, Time, Newsweek, and U.S. News and World Report. There were weekly general interest publications like Collier's and the Saturday Evening Post. There were picture magazines like Life and Look. And Americans knew a lot of the same things. And what they did was they disagreed over what those things meant, what conclusions it drove them to, and what to do about a world, but they agreed on the shape of the world. And now the question was, let's argue about what to do about it. Now we don't even have a patch of ground to stand on that we hold in common so that we can even argue about what to do next. When violent crime reaches a 50-year low and the President of the United States says it's at a 50-year high, well, arguably, you would do two different things. If you were in a society where it was at a 50-year high, you would behave and make policies and react in one way. If you were in a society where it was at a 50-year low, you'd say, wow, let's figure out what we've done right and keep on doing it. Or let's go to the places that still haven't experienced that decline in crime and bring the successful models from those places where it worked. But a society where we can't even agree, we can't even assess our own risk, understand whether we're really at danger, that's a centerless society. And while it's wonderful and small d democratic to have all these new voices and new presumed centers of authority that want to pick up the mantle of the old places that we've believed, I don't think we've gotten there yet. Nobody believes anybody right now. And that's a little bit of a scary world at the same time as it's one that's more democratic and allows you to believe what you want to believe more.
More democratic? I'm not so sure. In fact, I wonder if democracy itself might be the casualty in this Balkanization that we are talking about. And I'm with you. I don't want to be, and I am not a nostalgist. I don't believe the past is better. I don't want to give anybody that impression. I love the present, excited to be living in a time that is as complex as ours. And I think that we also have a responsibility to stand up and look at it from a variety of perspectives. Before I go to the issue of democracy and what is it, how messy it has become in the United States and the role that media ought to play in it and that it should play in the future, it seems to me that there's another element with this absence of a center. And of course, the very line, "the center cannot hold," comes from a very famous Irish poem that is about discovery. It is also about the sense that we are living in a time where old idols no longer can carry us forward. And that is that Now there are cameras and screens and microphones everywhere. Everybody, as we were saying in the first episode, is a journalist or is a video recorder. And just as it happens in a basketball game or in a football game or in baseball, where the batter just hits a home run and runs to first base, almost automatically looking at the screen at the top to see himself and the audience behind celebrating, the very act of being trapped in a box of resonance where we are seeing and listening to ourselves, seeing and listening, is a kind of a mad box as well. A box where we are so infatuated with our narcissism and with our ego that everything has to be projected and reflected. Everything is a mirror mediated by the media. And it seems to me that we have lost a high degree of privacy, a high degree of intimacy, because everything ends up on your Facebook feed or on Twitter. Now, going back to democracy, I am convinced, in the line of the political theory of Hannah Arendt and others, that a healthy, vigorous democracy without a solid, critical media is impossible. You need to have that other estate, the fourth estate, to be able to think critically, as we were mentioning before. By its very definition, democracy is messy. It needs to be messy. Tyranny is clean and septic. It wants only one viewpoint. Having many viewpoints is problematic, but it's good for skeptics. It's good for doubt. Now, too much of that might be bad. Again, I came to the United States. I chose this country. I love this country. I also feel it's my duty to be critical to this country. And it seems to me that what makes this country a country, immigrants coming from all over, is that we will have a common core. And the media and education have played that role of having a common core. And I question if the very fabric of this society is under threat because that common core at the level of media is so fragmented, so balkanized.
You know, I talk to audiences around the country about this very thing, the question of whether we have to be bound like other countries are bound by heritage and blood and language and clan and tribe because we don't have a common core. And I propose the opposite, that if you talk to someone who got here 15 years ago or 10 years ago, they're not the person who landed at Kennedy Airport or walked across the Friendship Bridge in El Paso Juarez. They're not the person that arrived on a ship all those years ago. They have been changed by the experience of living here just as they have changed here by living here. And I stress to audiences all the time that it is a cross-pollinization, that the two entities, the country and the new person, are constantly trading DNA, trading information, that people who are wringing their hands about this country losing its sense of itself because we let in too many people from other places have very little confidence in the essential nature of what this country does, which is make Americans out of people from everywhere, just as we take on aspects of their stray DNA. Our music sounds a little different. What we eat becomes a little different. What we laugh at becomes a little different. And just as marriage counselors, when you ask them, what do most successful couples do well? They'll tell you, they know how to fight with each other, that they have to be able to fight in a way that helps them solve their problems instead of tearing each other apart. We're like a country that's wondering what to do about a bad marriage. We don't know how to fight with each other anymore. And instead of helping us, the symbols of authority are sort of backing off from the fight. You know, Ayn Rand got her name for the book Atlas Shrugged from a sense that Atlas, instead of straining to hold up the world, could at one point just put it down and walk away. Well, our Atlas-style authority centers no longer have the kind of muscle they had to help give us that center, that gives us the patch to stand on, to fight it out and come to some sort of common wisdom about anything. Now we no longer even agree on the premises on which to have the struggle. So, and you brought up the example of immigration, we have a president who tells us that people are pouring over the border. And this is not a term that he uses accidentally, but he tells us day in and day out that people are pouring over the border, that we have no laws, that we have no system, when anybody who's ever been a part of that system knows that quite the opposite is true. And in fact, people are not pouring over the border. They're coming over in numbers that are the lowest that they've been in 20 years. What we do about it, how we argue about what's best going forward, how we make some rules that actually can be followed. We can't have those arguments because such large portions of the country are convinced of such entirely different things. I've never been as pessimistic about our ability to solve our problems. I'm not a pessimist about America in general, but I've never been as pessimistic as I am at the moment about our ability to solve our problems like 250 million adults, which is what we are. We've got to decide a lot of important things, and we've got to decide them soon. And we've moved from being the can-do country that always figures out how to do things to the can't-do country, paralyzed, unable to have a fight that gets us to something that's useful and durable and wise.
Maybe that pessimism is not Ray Suarez's pessimism. It's a general mode and mood that is permeating the 250 million people, and it's finding some resistance in small quarters, but probably not strong enough. I have imagined, in a kind of science fiction way, if I wanted to create a new country right now, what would be the ingredients that I would need? In a territory out of nowhere, in an island or in a continent that is empty, I don't want to fall into the paradigm of Palestine and Zionism in the endless wars that
or manifest destiny, to bring the example closer to home.
Well. But what do I need? I need a flag. I need a currency and a central bank. I need a sense of common history. If I am going to build this country or this nation based on immigrants that are going to come from all over, a common language, it is for me crucial. I want them to, at some point, you were talking about how immigrants change America and America changes immigrants, that the dialectical movement that is so enchanting and so part of this very country, the United States. And I think you need also a leader or a group that will convince in this new nation that I'm inventing that there is a history that justifies that nation, that it is created for and with a purpose, that there is an original sin or a myth that gave place to maybe manifest destiny, maybe exceptionalism, maybe the idea that everybody else is corrupt and that we can be better. Maybe this religious thought that there's redemption somewhere on the other side of the mountain. You can't build a nation, you can't build a community without a sense of hope. And that sense of hope then needs to come together. There's another crucial element. And that element is the capacity of that group to think as a group, not as a sum of individuals, but a collectivity that will see itself as a community. If the 100 or 1,000 or 250 million will think as 250 million, then my question will be, did I succeed to create a nation, or did I simply bring them together into a new territory? That, to me, is where I wonder if this divorce that you're talking about, this threat of a divorce, is actually a divorce that could happen. And I confess, the way many others, to have felt during this past 2, 3, 4 years, before the inaugural of 2017 with Trump coming to power, if this country would ultimately be broken into pieces, if there were states like California or Maine that would move in another direction, if there were parts that would secede, There are plenty of regions in the world, as you and I speak right now, Catalonia in Spain, Scotland, Quebec, the Kurds, that are thinking that they would be better off outside of the national landscape, outside of the configuration that originally entrapped them or encapsulated them as a nation, because they no longer fit there. And might there be a moment now where we wonder if we all no longer fit into the same salad bowl?
This inability to have a good, productive fight that actually leads to some sort of conclusion, that leads to some sort of shared goal, has got us speculating about a post-US world in a way that is disturbing to me. And yet, I see more people writing about it, more people talking about it, more people speculating about it than ever before in my adult lifetime. The old idea was that whatever our differences were, we were sort of, at the end of the day, stuck with each other. As one writer put it, one America after all. That's the one I live in, where there are people who have very different conclusions about the shape of the world from my own, but we share enough that we can stay in contact with each other. We can stay in contact and conversation with each other. But now, many more of those people are rejecting my claim to be part of the civic whole, especially on social media where you can be anonymous. People say horrifying things to me about whether I belong in this country, whether the family that brought me here was legitimately allowed to become part of the civic whole, whether I am an inheritor of a shared history, the way they assume that they are because of where they come from and the color of their skin. So I used to dismiss claims about the dangers of those speculations. I don't anymore. I still think at the end of the day we will rush into each other's arms somehow. Maybe that's just cockeyed optimism. Maybe it's based on enough experience where we fight, and then finally we realize we do need each other. But there are many, many more Americans who believe that they are no longer part of the same thing as I am. If I have that problem, I can only imagine how you have that problem.
Absolutely. And that is because when I put together a book, say an anthology of texts that come from other people, and I've done it in my life a number of times, I have come to the realization that I am actually putting two books together. The book with everything that went in and the book with everything that was left out. And the book that with everything that was left out is as important as the other one, though I want, in my role as an editor, to convince he or she who's going to open my book that that which went in is better than that which was left out. And in thinking of a nation or a collectivity, I have come to the same conclusion. In order to build a nation, you create it by those that are in, and you distinguish those that are in by those that are out. Because you are French, meaning not British, meaning not Spanish or Portuguese or Italian. Or you are Brazilian, meaning not Venezuelan or Puerto Rican or Jamaican or Chilean or what have you, whatever other countries are surrounding. That, in terms of borders, makes sense because you need to create a border to say, this is where I begin, this is where you end, or this is where I end and where you begin. It's healthy to live with neighbors when you know that your neighbors have their own space and you have yours, and that you can be respectful to one another. The problem, as you are putting it, is that we within the nation are doubting that those that are our fellow citizens are as essential, as important players as we are. And in questioning those that are in, we are creating a sense of internal exile, of separation, of denigration of others. I think that social media is part of the media. And I think that it is probably the most dangerous part. And you and I have been talking about the media as having dangerous edges, precisely because it is so easy to undermine the values and the principles of others. And precisely because we in social media, when we are anonymous, can easily go from the rational to the emotional. And that's a topic that I would like us to go into when we enter our next episode. What is it that makes sense to the intellect, and how far have we gone in order to go to the raw emotional side of what the news are?
Let us know what you think about this In Contrast special. Review us on Apple Podcasts or send an email to radio@nepr.net. You can also follow us on Facebook, where we invite you to share your comments on this program and others in our series. To find out more about all of our In Contrast programs, visit our website at nepr.net/In Contrast. Our music is by the Fresh Cut Orchestra. The executive producer of In Contrast is John Vosey. I'm Ilan Stavans.
And I'm Ray Suarez. Thank you for listening.
In Contrast is a production of New England Public Radio and Quixote Productions.